Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
You can work from the road while turning your vehicle into a powerful high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On a network that covers more roads than any other carrier. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls. Finish up that presentation or answer last-minute emails. Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi to see if you're eligible for a free trial today. Based on independent third-party data, always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com. Hey guys, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. This is Julie Douglas talking at you today. Today's episode, Objects of Love, is an encore presentation that we're rolling out and dusting off mainly because we just laid out about five or so Valentine-themed episodes in an attempt to take love and lust down to the studs for examination. So as a sort of palate cleanser, we thought we'd offer up this episode on the stuff we love and the reasons why we cling to it so. But don't worry, we are not going to take away your woobie, a.k.a. your blankie. So enough preamble. We hope that you enjoy today's episode.
Julie, do you have any magical objects with you today? Any good luck charms? Any personal items of importance?
Nope. I was thinking about this. Yeah. I'm not really into the sort of magical thinking lucky items, I have to say.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Wait, hold up your hands. Do you have any rings on? Oh, you don't have any rings on.
Look, nothing.
Wow. Nothing, huh? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I have my lucky underwear on. Maybe I don't. You? Underwear.
No, well, I mean, nothing. Let's see, what do I have on me? Right now, I have my wedding ring, and I do. There's a certain amount of magical thinking involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have any? No, I don't have any amulets on me right now. But I've certainly fallen into the habit of using them. I think I've talked about this before. I previously had a Ganesha,
you know, remover of obstacles.
Remover of obstacles, the Hindu god that has the elephant appearance.
Featured on The Simpsons in a hilarious episode.
Yes, also made fun of there. But I would carry it around because, you know, remover of obstacles and, you know, all this various ties into creativity and all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would carry that in my pocket. And then eventually I lost it. Like, it crawled out in the washing machine or something and left me. And so I've always felt, I felt kind of bad. I'm like, where did Ganesha go? Did Ganesha abandon me? And then I found Ganesha, put him back in,
mm-hmm.
and then he disappeared again and hasn't come back. And also in the past, I'll occasionally like pick up a rock. Like if I'm at the beach and I'm having a particularly good day, I'll pick up that rock and take it with me, and that'll end up in my pocket for maybe a year or so. You know, because that kind of comes to symbolize like a nice memory, and so I can take it out and I can sort of think back to that time.
So what I'm hearing is that you have various kinds of woobies.
Woobies?
Woobies, yeah. What? Security blankets.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I guess they are, to a certain extent, security blankets.
I mean, they're not, you know, apples to apples, but there is this sort of warm and fuzzy thing that you're trying to evoke with an object, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's... I mean, it's weird for me because, like, if I'm holding a Ganesha, I don't actually think that I'm using this as a totem to get in touch with some sort of a god.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's not like a literal interpretation of the amulet, but there is a certain amount of positive thinking that comes with having it. And I've also wondered a lot of times when I'm passing by my own desk or coworkers' desks or seeing somebody's desk on TV where they have action figures.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, like a dude's desk, you know, have various action figures. And I wonder to what extent are modern action figures kind of akin to the amulets of old? You know, like today we don't have a pantheon of gods to really call upon for the most part. But instead we have all these various pop culture icons and cartoon characters that represent various things, at least on like a subconscious level. And we keep them around to draw strength from them.
You haven't found the Pantheon room? The HSW Pantheon room?
No, do we have one?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
But you next know, to the room with the black toilet and the black sink.
Yeah?
Yeah, the superhero bathroom.
Okay, well, see, I've been missing that. But if you pass by my desk, you pass by, like, Jonathan Strickland's desk, you mm-hmm. pass by Izzy's office, you'll see little figures, you know? So I wonder to what extent, I mean, and obviously they're on our desk, they're in our workspace, they're in our work environment informing, you know, our relationship with our work, with what we're trying to do, and representing a little bit of who we are. So to what extent are those becoming deities? I don't know.
Well, okay, so that's what we're going to try to get to the bottom of today. We're going to look at objects, our relationship to objects, and we're going to try to figure out how much of this has to do with our own ability to acquire things and whether or not this acquisitiveness is natural to us. And then we're going to look a little bit at compulsive hoarding, too.
When it comes to materialism, it is really a distinctive human trait for the most part, especially when you look at its more outrageous examples. The one that I was really partial to was the one brought up by Steve Taylor in his article, The Madness of Materialism, which just a great short little article. But he mentions gold, especially the like European colonists' love of gold and their clashes with native peoples in the Americas. There's one example that he brings up where an Indian chief in Cuba learned that the Spanish sailors were about to attack his land.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually prays to the spirit of the gold for aid. Like they're trying to figure out why are these people so into gold, this shiny rock from the ground? They must have some sort of, they must believe it's a god. They mm-hmm. must believe that it has supernatural powers. Because otherwise, why would you go to such ridiculous ends? Why would you wage all this bloodshed, just to get it?
Right, because otherwise it's like, well, you guys are just acting like ferrets going after something shiny.
Yeah.
So surely this piece of gold has something to it. And he prayed to it, right? And
didn't work.
Didn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because as he points out in this article, Steve Taylor points out, a certain amount of hoarding of resources makes evolutionary sense. You know, we've talked before, in the wild, there are certain things that are scarce. I mean, food itself is going to be scarce to varying degrees. And so to whatever degree we can plan ahead, that we can stockpile it,
mm-hmm.
the better off we'll be. If that means burying nuts in the yard, if that means you know, finding something that is more rare in nature, like sugar, and being able to store that away, like all that makes sense. Firewood, I mean, there are things that are part of our survival that makes sense when we're hoarding it.
Well, it makes sense, I think, to a culture that is settled. But if you look back at early man, and particularly the fact that early man was a nomadic species,
mm-hmm.
Then you know that hoarding or stockpiling just really wasn't convenient.
That's right. I mean, yeah, if you're always on the move, if you even if you have kind of like cyclical patterns to your movement, in, you know, going from, you know, north to south depending on what the weather's doing, yeah, you're not going to be able to carry all of this with you. You could maybe stockpile some of it, but you're not going to carry it all on your back.
Yeah, so there's this big question mark, like, is this really genetic? Is this something that's natural to humans, this impulse to buy and possess things? Or is it something that really is more symptomatic of modern man, particularly from the 19th century on, right?
Yeah.
When things became much easier to produce cheaply and then to acquire cheaply.
Yeah, and I mean, when it comes to stockpiling things that are important, I mean, once we get out of this transitory nature of culture, and we get into actually settling in areas and growing food, I mean, being able to stockpile food, I mean, that's part and parcel to a lot of our cultural growth as a species, our ability to put food away, have more food than we need, and then specialize our roles within a community.
But what about just buying lots of plastic things, right, yeah, and putting them in a storage unit, and then that storage unit being auctioned off in a show called Storage Wars or something like that, right?
Yeah, because then it seems like we're definitely getting into pathological area. We're getting into, right, an area where it is a sickness. It is a natural instinct that has been perverted. Because even though the native peoples of the Americas couldn't understand the lust for gold, if you put gold within the context of wealth, and then wealth equals
power,
wealth equals comfort, wealth equals food, then I can see the cognitive steps, you know, necessary to think, I got to have all the gold.
Right, because I have to possess the symbol of it, which is probably a large part of why we do have this such a high degree of acquisitiveness, right? Like, mm-hmm, of wanting to acquire everything. But, you know, the question is it genetic? Well, there was a study by Justine Giddens, Julie Shermer, and Philip Vernon from the University of Western Ontario, and they wanted to know how much of it was environmental, how much of it was genetic. So, of course, they turned to twins. They recruited 240 pairs of twins, identical and fraternal. And they looked at the benchmark of individual differences, personality, values, happiness. And we know about 45% of those traits are heritable, right? Mm-hmm. So to the surprise of these researchers, they found that individual differences in materialism were almost entirely attributed to environmental factors and not a genetic thing going on here.
Okay.
So that kind of makes sense, right? And that actually makes sense to me in the context of hoarding, because yes, hoarding does have some pathological brain disorder elements to it, but a lot of the triggers for hoarding are environmental. So, you know, if you had a loved one who recently passed away or something that was life-changing, uh-huh, that can sort of flip the switch in hoarding behavior. And when I talk about hoarding behavior, I'm talking about an excessive collection of objects.
This is like one of those things where it's like, I must keep every newspaper that has ever come out.
And it's not just keep them, but like if you were to be separated from those newspapers, you would suffer.
Yeah.
You would feel pain. You would be confused. You'd have an inability to really make clear-headed decisions about the sort of stuff in your life.
Yeah, and you've seen one of these shows. To me, that's enough.
Because, the hoarding shows.
Yeah, because it can be a bit much to take in. It can be. I mean, they're kind of depressing. But I think I saw one once where it was like food items, and it wasn't in a sense that like I need to save all the sweet potatoes because I love sweet potatoes and I need to eat these sweet potatoes later. But it would be like, oh, this sweet potato looked really good. This is a really cool looking sweet potato, and like this weird emotional attachment to the sweet potato, and then it must be kept even though it's rotting in the refrigerator.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Yeah, well, it turns out that people who have hoarding behavior or hoarding disorder, they actually have a part of their brain, this is the anterior cingulate cortex, this part of their brain is actually not behaving the same way as quote-unquote normal people, because that is the part of the brain that's actually governing your decisions. And
your restraint, is that also playing into
some impulse control, yeah. But primarily, it's the decision-making. And so if you take people who have the hoarding disorder and you look at them in MRI scans, when they are considering whether or not to part from an object that they own, you'll see that you'll see the fuzzy nature going on there. So you know that it is a brain disorder. It is this part of their brain that is saying, I just don't know what to do here.
Yeah.
And so it's not just like, oh, okay, I need to have everything in the world, or there's some sort of gluttonous, you know, void that they're trying to fill. It really is coming from the decisions that they're brain circuitry is making. And I thought this was really interesting when I found out about it. Hoarding behavior actually has some connection, or a lot of connection, to narcissism. So you think about narcissism and you think about vanity.
Yeah, you think about narcissists, you think about the reflection in the pool, captivated by one's appearance.
But it really is sort of a coping mechanism. And I believe it was Dr. Rebecca Beaton, she explained this to me a couple years ago when I interviewed her about hoarding. She told me that kids who are feeling abandoned from their parents, or they don't have a significant relationship with a parent, or really any sort of guardian. In other words, they're not getting that emotional connection, or even sort of the touch, the hug, or any of that. They begin to turn inward, and they begin to become narcissists because they have to find self-comfort from themselves, and some of that gets attributed to objects. So then they begin to collect objects as this part of comfort.
Okay.
And that's where you see the behavior played out.
And, of course, this brings to mind the Peanuts character, Linus,
Oh, right.
And his blanket, right?
His Wooby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his comfort blanket, or if you want to get into the more technical terms, his comfort object, his transitional object,
mm-hmm.
Which is something you see with a lot of kids. I mean, it's, let's see, did I have, no, my, now my sister definitely had a blanket. Called Blanky, and it got to the point where they ended up like cutting off the edge of Blanky so that she could continue to carry Blanky around with her. And I think she may still have, I think she still keeps Blanky around.
Well, you know, my daughter's 4, mm-hmm. and the same thing has happened to her blanket. She calls it Blanky's Blanky.
Wait, now I'm confused.
The part that came off that she carries around is called Blanky's Blanky.
So it's the blank, like the shard of Blanky. It's mm-hmm. all right. It's like a. Like it's kind of like a religious artifact,
kind of. And she hides it in her bed, and she's really freaky about it. Like we can't find it. It's like Blanky's Blanky.
Well, I mean, it, to an uninformed observer, it could seem a little freaky because it is kind of borderline religious obsession. It may seem like. In fact, if you go back to the 1940s, attachment to a special object by a child was regarded as just pathological behavior. It was mm-hmm. just a case of childhood fetish reflecting something askew in the mother-child relationship.
Like
you must be doing something wrong because your kid has this gross scrap of a blanket that they're carrying around.
And I think it's interesting that they look at it as a fetish, particularly mm-hmm. if you kind of take a wide-angle view of that period anyway, where you see a lot of this the ideas of fetish or fetishism coming out. But yeah, it wasn't until the 50s, right, when they started to say, you know what, this is actually a normal thing. It's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. People like D.W. Wincott started defining these as normal and necessary and as a transitional experience, a key step in an infant's ability to distinguish this inner subjective world from the outside reality. So, you know, through the 70s and 80s, there was still this sort of, people were still clinging to this old notion that there's something wrong, that the kid has some, you know, some anxiety problems or something, and that's why they're holding on to it. But really the academic understanding of it was pretty much in place.
Yeah, because they began to understand that this could really help allay some of the fears, some of the anxieties that children have. Of course they have them, because remember, they have an entirely new view of life.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to categorize every loud sound, every image, and try to make sense of it. Is it a threat? Is it not a threat? And so this transitional object really does help, because it is sort of like the stand-in for, you know, a parental unit or something else. There's a study by G.J. Ibarra, R.H. Passman, and C. Eisenberg, and they found that during a routine third-year pediatric examination, the security object enhanced rapport with the examining nurse, and then children attached to a blanket who were allowed access to it were rated as less distressed, and they experienced less physiological stress. And that is evidenced by the heart rate and the systolic blood pressure. So this is in contrast to kids who are undergoing medical evaluation without their woobies, really.
Yeah. And certainly these woobies, as you said, they can end up becoming like an important parenting tool, I understand, as well. I mean, if you use it wisely, right? I mean, it's powerful stuff to play with. But I was reading about how, you know, a parent can use it to their advantage. You know, a kid needs the woobie to remain comfortable in a position
sure.
when the mother's away.
I think it's really important to, like around age 1 and so on and so forth, when they start to feel the separation anxiety, as you mm-hmm. say, like leaving the house or even just sleeping at night. I think having something to grab onto is really important.
One of the interesting things about studying transitional objects is that there's ultimately a kind of a lack of uniformity in the definition of it, and also the cultural significance of mm-hmm. it. Like some of the cultural stats are pretty interesting. Like the United States, 60% of children have at least a mild degree of attachment to some sort of soft inanimate object. And I think looking back, I had a stuffed rhinoceros named Wrenchy that had an attachment to. but I don't know. Then you're getting into like stuffed animals. You're getting into a whole different area because those have personalities. I don't know. Does Blanky's Blanky have a personality, do you think?
Well, sometimes Blanky's Blanky gets in trouble or does things like takes all the toilet paper off the toilet roll or something like that. But generally, I think that's just general scoundrelness right now.
Well, okay, so anyway, 60% of children in the U.S. Have some sort of mild degree. 32% exhibit strong attachment.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you look at incidences of attachment in the Netherlands and New Zealand and Sweden, that's comparable to the United States. Korean children have substantially fewer attachments to blankets, down to 18%. That compared to American children, but in Korean-born children living in the United States to play an intermediate percentage of 34%. 5% of rural Italian children have transitional objects compared to 31% of urban Italians. And it goes as far as 62% of foreign children living in Rome. So I don't know, you just see the stats, I guess, kind of skewing towards urban areas.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's interesting to see that it can be, you know, within one country, you could have such a, so many different variables there. And
But in London, just 16% of children have a special security object, and that's London. So there goes the urban argument. See, it's hard to find the exactly what's going on. There's just so many cultural factors to look at there, I guess.
Well, and you have to wonder too if part of that is just to say like that's not as accepted, and therefore maybe in that culture, it's not as encouraged, or it's not maybe as prominent. People don't see it as much.
Yeah, or maybe there's less of a culture of these are my objects and these are your objects, and it's more these are our objects, you know?
Some of this had to do with memory, too, right? Like they would go back and say, oh, did I have an object that I was connected to? And so they're collecting some of this data from faulty memory where people are saying yes or no, and they couldn't exactly remember. I also wanted to point out, too, that, you know, a transitional object is very different from a pacifier. And of course, a pacifier is something that's used to self-soothe in babies.
Right.
But I kind of think of it as gum for babies. You know, it's an activity to try to help them with their eventual eating skills, their swallowing skills. And it kind of helps keep them occupied if they're hungry and you're trying to prepare a bottle or something like that. But it is very different in terms of comfort.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a quick break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend? Or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Okay, so we're back.
Yeah, and we're going to get into the realm of magical thinking. This is territory that we've moved through many times before, but it continues to be important because it really does deal with how we think about the world versus how the world really is. I mean, magical thinking, of course, is the belief that an object, action, or circumstance not logically related to a course of events can influence its outcome. So in magical thinking, you get into all these ideas of everything from a haunted house, the idea that, oh, something bad happened here, so now something is bad with the house. You know, like the idea that an event can affect the physical object, or even like mere mementos. I've mentioned my father's watch before. You know, like obviously that's something that has significance to me, and there's a certain amount of magical thinking involved there. You know, even if it's at a subconscious level, even if I'm not thinking, oh, this has the spirit of my dad in it, I think, oh, that was his watch, and there is some sense of him about it.
Mm-hmm.
So magical thinking kind of, you know, is intertwined in all our lives, to varying degrees, you know, be it conscious or subconscious. One of the more conscious ways, of course, is with the idea of a lucky charm.
Yeah, and there's something called apophenia, and that is seeing patterns where there are none. And that is a little bit of the soup base to magical thinking, right? Because, again, if you, let's say you're wearing something and something great happens, you think, oh, those are those lucky socks. I must wear them every time that I have to do this certain challenge.
Yeah.
And you begin to make this causal connection.
But then there's always that difference between, oh, I've got a big interview, I'm going to wear those lucky socks of mine. There's that, and then there's, these are my lucky socks, I must wear them every day, and they must never be washed, or they must be washed exactly 8 times to contain their magic. You know, I mean, there's a line between just sort of helpful magical thinking and helpful lucky charm belief to, and then there's a whole realm of pathology.
Well, that gets a little OCD in a way, yeah. Right? It's called adventitious reinforcing, and that is making that connection and then keep, you know, doing whatever that ritual is over and over again so that you can hopefully, you know, evoke those spirits of magic to help you in your quest.
So has anyone studied lucky charms? Of course
the
they
cereal?
Have.
The cereal?
Yeah, well, not the cereal. The cereal, that's a whole different kettle of fish. But yes, as far as studying the effects that lucky charms, lucky objects have on us, there's a really cool study from the University of Cologne in 2010. And they started off with just golf. They invited these test subjects to come and see how many of 10 putts they could make from the same location.
Mm-hmm.
And when the experimenters handed them a golf ball, they would sometimes just give them the ball and say, "Hey, everyone's used this ball so far. You know, no big deal. Here's a golf ball. Why don't you hit it and see if it'll go in that hole over there?" And then sometimes they said, "Hey, this ball, this must be a lucky ball. This one's really worked well for people."
Mm-hmm.
And then they analyzed it. They let everyone play a little golf, see what happened. And the mere suggestion that the ball was lucky significantly influenced performance, causing participants to make almost 2 more putts on average.
See, this is where, like, when David Eagleman says, like, we don't have any free will, I began to really sort of say, you know, he might be onto something. Because the mere suggestion that it's lucky would actually have some sort of bearing on your performance. That's crazy, you know?
It is, yeah. So, of course, they weren't going to stop just there.
No.
Because generally, if you have a scientific experiment, if you have a study going on, and it begins and ends with people just playing golf one afternoon, you know, that's probably not enough. You need to push it a little further.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. So what they did is they had test subjects come in, and they had them bring lucky artifacts with them, you know, be it their old blankie or their, you know, like me. I forgot about this. I always bring this Triceratops squeeze toy into the office with me.
It's true.
Yeah, and I don't think of it as a lucky charm. I think of it more as like something to occupy my hand when I'm feeling kind of fumbly.
But you don't podcast without it.
I don't podcast without it. So there's a certain amount of magical thinking involved there, a certain amount of good luck charm going on with that Triceratops. So anyway, they invited people to bring in their Triceratops toys, their lucky four-leaf clovers, what have you, and then they started the tests. They assigned them to either a condition where they would be performing a task in the presence of their charm or in absence of their charm. And then the participants rated their perceived level of self-efficiency and then completed a memory task that was essentially a variant of the classic card game concentration.
So psychologist Lisan Damish, she found that those people who had their lucky charms, they were doing a couple of things here to improve their performance. Because really, it does improve your performance,
yeah, that was
right?
The thing. They found, once again, if they had their lucky charms on hand, they did better.
Yes. They were setting loftier goals for themselves. And then they were exhibiting increased persistence, right? They did not give up as easily because they felt bolstered by these lucky charms.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy. I mean, it's the idea that so here's the Triceratops squishy in my hand and bringing it in. I'm thinking, well, I've got the Triceratops with me. I'm not just going to go for normal. I'm going to shoot for higher because I've got the power up in my hand.
Well,
and then
so,
I'm going to stick to it more because I'm focusing my attention. I have the symbol of my commitment with me as well.
Well, here's where the funhouse mirror shatters. If you are aware of this effect, then supposedly this no longer works anymore.
That's,
if you become conscious that you are attributing magical qualities to an object, then it supposedly is not going to be effective.
You know, and I don't really buy that part of the study.
You don't?
Well, I think it depends. I think that this depends on the individual. Because for my own part, I find myself able to drift in and out of believing in things,
mm-hmm.
depending on what my day-to-day outlook is and depending on, you know, how I want to view the world. Like, I find myself able to a certain extent, you know, engage in the belief that an object might have some sort of, luck, or believe in some varying levels of spirituality, depending on how I'm viewing the day. So I can imagine somebody, you know, logically knowing that something is just a piece of metal, but then still buying into it enough to get that effect out of it.
Well, I think that's because you have a creative, fiction-twisted mind that's been trained that way. So you can, I think, dive into magical thinking very easily.
Yeah, well,
and then still be hanging out with reality.
Yeah, but I don't. And I'm not unique in that aspect.
No. I mean, a lot
of
people can do that.
Like that. Yeah. So I think the study's fascinating, though. I do kind of disagree on that part about the idea that just merely by listening to this podcast, we have deactivated all of your lucky charms out there. I mean, some of you, if you're the right kind of person, then we just totally zapped all of your magic doodads.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
All right. So let's change the subject and close this podcast out on IKEA, because IKEA, what is this but the iconic symbol of all objects known to man that can be acquired by man, right?
Right. And of course, the thing we always come back to with IKEA, anytime we're talking about IKEA, anytime we're thinking about IKEA, and I'm not talking about on the podcast, but just in general, all of us, is the assembly of these items. They come with the really well designed graphically instructions, and you bring them home and you try to make sense out of them, and then you take one or two, three or four goes at assembling it correctly.
Now,
generally, with some, there's a little bit, it's like going through a maze, because you end up hitting a dead corner, and then you realize, oh, I already used those screws in the wrong spot. Let's see if they can actually be removed without destroying the product.
Is that little, is it the L, is that a Allen wrench?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That thing is ridiculous to me, because you have all these pieces in front of you, and then you have this tiny little Allen wrench that's supposed to do the job.
Well, you can get a screwdriver with the Allen wrench.
Well, power tools always come out. That's the joke of it, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like the little man that is...
Yeah.
That is the symbol of the person that's supposed to be you, is overly comical, too. And it's sort of like this commentary on the whole process.
I think he's supposed to be kind of disarming as well when you reach that frustration point with it.
See, I see his visage as being mocking.
He's laughing at you. As you're just sitting in the living room floor, just surrounded by half-assembled furniture. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Beating away.
Yeah. I mean, there have been times when I've been assembling IKEA furniture. And I love IKEA furniture. But there have been times when I've been assembling it where I've just about lost my mind.
Well, see, I think that is what plays into this whole idea of this IKEA effect, right?
Right. And this is the idea. Ultimately, it's the idea that if we build something ourselves, even if it's crap, we care more about it. And we've all encountered this with people. You know, it's anybody that knows somebody who engages in a bit of art, a bit of creative endeavor, but be it somebody who's really good at it, or, you know, someone who's new to the practice, there's a tendency to love your own work, even when it's not good.
Well, I mean, you see this in fiction writing a lot, yeah. Right? When you're going through the editing process, is that, what was it, the term, kill your children? You don't want to do it. Kill your darlings. You don't want to, this is your creation, and it doesn't fit in, and it doesn't really even matter to the plot line anymore, but it's very hard to get rid of those things.
Yeah. I mean, it's why you need an outsider to come in and look at your stuff. That's the beauty of the editor. That's why, I have Allison Loudermilk around to edit my work for the website, because otherwise stuff would remain in there that really needs to be cut. You need a hard, cruel Loudermilk.
she is not cruel.
to come in and take out all the unimportant organs. Just rip them right out of the body.
Yeah, you do need someone putting in comments next to your work saying, hey, what's up with this?
Yeah.
But see, this is really interesting about the IKEA effect is that, in the NPR story about this called Why You Love That IKEA Table, Even If It's Crooked, they're saying that people don't have this editor coming in, and you see this in companies. You see people getting really tied to this idea of what a product is or what it is that they're making. And sometimes it's 2 years in the making.
Yeah, you're putting just loads of time and energy into it, and you're in the jungle with it.
You're in the jungle, and then someone from the outside comes in and goes, it's crooked.
Yeah.
And that you need that. You need that sort of fresh perspective. So that's helpful. I mean, we've kind of transitioned away from objects more into philosophy here, but hey, I mean, isn't that what objects are doing in the first place? They're just metaphors for us, really.
Yeah. So the study was big on stressing that building your own stuff boosts your feeling of pride and competence, signals to others that you are competent, which I think is good as well, and reminds me of that recent Portlandia sketch. Did you see this with the dude who builds his own furniture?
No, I didn't see that one.
He's like the all the women want to date him and marry him and make him their own because they learn, oh, he makes his own furniture.
Right.
You know, because, like, it's just the perfect thing, right? But then they find out that he makes really crappy furniture, but he just doesn't realize it. So it kind of fits in with what we're talking about. But the third thing that they found in the study that was interesting was that, and this is a direct quote from the study, threatening consumers' sense of self increases their propensity to make things themselves. So the idea here that the author talks about in this article is that theoretically, if you were to provide a visitor to IKEA mm-hmm. with a really difficult math problem,
right.
to really bust them down a few chops and make them feel kind of stupid, then let them into IKEA, they're going to be even more into the idea of buying something and building it themselves.
So they can make good again? So
yeah,
their ego has been taken down a couple notches, and then if they can just assemble something, they can regain that?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the idea?
I think so, because it's kind of like anything. You know, whenever you're logged in a process that is just seemingly never ending, that you don't really feel like there's a sense of completion, or you have one of those days where you work on 18 different things and finish none of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what you really want to do is nail something. You want to say, I went home and I made a grilled cheese from start to finish, and then I ate it. Case closed. Close that loop.
Well, that would get you a lot of ladies.
Yeah.
Hey, he makes cheese.
He makes cheese. Yeah. Well, not from start to finish, not making your own bread and cheese, though that would be impressive as well.
But, yeah. I don't know. This is what the author was saying, is that maybe IKEA could start to game their customers to their advantage and give them these math problems, or just put up big placards that say, like, you know, you're awful and lousy. Put some furniture together and you'll feel better.
Yeah. I mean, some people love it. I know people that are just in love with the idea of putting together furniture.
Well, IKEA Hacker is a great website
to see what
people do to sort of change or to make it more unique, or try to game the furniture to have it have another purpose.
I've been saying for a while that IKEA needs to do like a game show where teams of IKEA hackers have to like compete against each other, and then maybe they're having to assemble furniture in weird places, like, you know, in a hot air balloon or on the subway. But
my boy, I think you got something there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did that sound like 1940s?
Yeah, a little bit.
All right.
So there you go, objects, a little insight into why we surround ourselves with so much stuff, why it's so important. And I was really interested in, you know, we were talking about that space that your mind occupies, that moment when you're holding something in your hand and trying to decide whether you can part with it and throw it away, or if it has value that and needs to be held and maintained. Like that to me is a very interesting frame of mind to occupy. I mean, we've all been there.
Yeah.
And we all kind of skew different ways, I think, when faced with that situation. Some of us will just throw stuff away at the drop of a hat. My wife is one, and she's been a good influence on me in making me more susceptible to getting rid of things instead of keeping them around needlessly until you just have boxes of notes and stuff.
Yeah, you know, if I'm in a store, which I don't really shop that much, but if I'm in a store and I see something I fancy, I actually will carry it around for about 15 minutes to see whether or not I actually want it. And 9 out of 10 times, I put it back. Thank you for joining us today in this episode. We hope this stokes some thought about your own material possessions and what they mean to you. And if you're interested in learning more about some of the themes covered today, like, say, magical thinking, you can check out stufftoblowyourmind.com. It's our online hub for past and present podcast episodes, videos, and blog posts all related to what we explore here in this podcast. And if you have thoughts on the objects in your life that bring you the most pleasure or even discomfort, we'd like to hear about them. You can send your words our way by emailing us at stufftoblowyourmind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro potting soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro potting soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.